Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on complex illness.
All right, well, welcome back. Again, I'm Lauren Goodman with OSU Pulmonary Critical Care and Palliative Medicine. And so this is another topic that is also near and dear to my heart. See lots and lots and lots of patients with COPD at varying stages. And really, it's all appropriate for palliation of varying levels. So we'll talk briefly about the series of diseases, the set of diseases that make up chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We'll talk briefly about their management and to some extent how that may phase into more of the end-of-life management and hospice in particular management. We'll talk about some of the symptoms that are most common with this set of diseases. And we'll talk briefly about prognostication and hospice indications. And a lot of this, unfortunately, remains clear as mud, in part because COPD is not one disease. It's a whole series of illnesses. Things as common as asthma, environmental changes are obviously one of the biggest factors in development of that classic emphysema and chronic bronchitis that we talk about. But it can also include things like HIV-associated emphysema. We see more and more of that, really precocious, premature emphysema in patients who have HIV. It's a really interesting phenomenon and unfortunately causes a lot of morbidity for those patients. Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is a pretty classic syndrome, pretty uncommon. We have a reasonable collection of patients at Ohio State who have it, variable severity. And some additional issues, particularly as it relates to the familial nature of the disease. And then less common forms. Bronchiectasis comes in a number of different forms and flavors. Things like cystic fibrosis certainly cause it, but there's any number of other factors that can contribute. And then bronchiolitis. And I will say that I most commonly see chronic bronchiolitis in the form of bronchiolitis obliterans after transplants, particularly after bone marrow transplants. And then there's a variety of other conditions that can lead to it. And you can imagine how with this variety of conditions causing, you know, adding to this constellation of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, it does change to some extent, at least the initial phase, the initial characteristics of the patients. COPD, sort of the classic that we think of, that emphysema, chronic bronchitis pattern, at this point is the fourth leading cause of death worldwide, projected to become the third leading cause of death worldwide by about 2020. In the U.S., it costs us about well over $30 billion a year. About at least half of that is due to the acute exacerbations alone, which is a pretty staggering number. Projected to go up to nearly 50 million in the next 4 years. And some of that is in, most of that is in healthcare costs. Some of that is in lost productivity. It's a tremendous cause of hospital readmissions. And if you experience the hospital triage system the way I do, can certainly cause to a lot of crowding in hospitals and a lot of lost opportunity to take care of patients or to continue to care for patients in the best possible setting. This is a disease of patients who have a lot of other issues as well. Some of them are separate from COPD. Some of them are perhaps because of the treatments for COPD. And sometimes it's hard to tell which is which. There's a fair amount of overlap between that classic emphysema, chronic bronchitis, with cardiovascular diseases, coronary artery disease in particular. Osteoporosis can be either a factor of nutrition and decreased activity, can be because of steroids, those sorts of things. Respiratory infections can cause some of these processes, but also are much more likely to happen, sometimes simply because of the anatomy and architecture of the lungs. But also there is some increased risk of respiratory infections with some of the treatments. Bronchiectasis, as we mentioned, can be a form of obstructive pulmonary disease, but you can also have a risk of developing additional bronchiectasis from particularly these infections. Mood disorders can be separate but contribute to additional symptoms with lung diseases, or can be exacerbated by, or even to some extent created by, the derangements that you get, the debility that you get with chronic lung disease. Diabetes, again, is one that can occur separately but concomitant with lung disease, or can be exacerbated by the treatments for it. And finally, there's a lot of overlap with lung cancers. Certainly many cancers, but lung cancer in particular. And when we think about the biomass fuels and tobacco smoke that are such a huge contributor to so many cases, it's easy to understand why that is. And so all of these comorbidities can really affect the quality of life and even the prognosis of our patients with lung disease. A brief review, the GOLD stages, Global Initiative for Obstructive Lung Diseases, looking through as our lung disease progresses, everyone who's even at risk deserves a flu shot and trying to avoid the risk factors. When you have simply mild obstruction, then an as-needed inhaler is sufficient. As you progress through the stages, we need to add things like long-acting scheduled bronchodilators, pulmonary rehab, we'll talk about in more depth in a minute, inhaled corticosteroids, particularly if you have repeated flares, and then oxygen, and there are some forms of surgery. I think we touched on surgery a little bit in our dyspnea talk, but we'll go into a little more detail. More recently, in the last 10 years or so, we've gone to classifying COPD more by classes rather than simply stages. Functional obstruction is certainly important, and degree of obstruction is certainly important, but additionally, exacerbations are important as well. And so the amount of dyspnea that you get is important. The number of exacerbations you have per year, whether those exacerbations lead to hospitalizations or not, layers on to the severity of your obstruction. And so if you've got up to moderate obstruction and not a lot of dyspnea, you're still a class A. If you don't have a lot of exacerbations, you're in that A or C, and grades, if you have more of the severe to very severe obstruction, where if you're having more exacerbations, your risk of more exacerbations down the road is higher. And so that's how we tend to classify more these days. You'll recall, and we won't talk too extensively about these, but the treatments for obstructive lung disease include beta agonists, whether short-acting or long-acting, inhaled anticholinergics, typically antimuscarinic, the corticosteroids. We start with the beta agonists. There's good evidence that adding the anticholinergic to a beta agonist at lower doses can be more beneficial than simply escalating the dose of either the anticholinergic or the beta agonist alone. adding inhaled corticosteroids is something of a double-edged sword. It can reduce exacerbations, but it can also increase our risk of pneumonia. And so that is something to be considered, certainly if you have a patient who's having frequent exacerbations, worth doing. If you have a patient who's not having frequent exacerbations, it is important to think about, gosh, is this still a good medication to continue? Routine use of systemic corticosteroids is not a good idea. The risks do outweigh the benefits in general. Certainly, I think each of us has seen those patients who just doesn't seem to be able to come off of them ever. And so for that individual patient, it's harder to say where the risk-benefit ratio falls. But if you have a patient who isn't absolutely stuck on those, it's certainly preferable to get them off and to keep them off as much as possible. In recent years, there is a new phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor, roflumilast, which is FDA approved for patients with severe to very severe obstruction who have chronic bronchitis and frequent exacerbations. This has been shown to reduce the frequency of exacerbations, and it can be a very helpful medication. Unfortunately, it does have some significant side effects, particularly of the GI variety, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and particularly if you have a patient who is starting out underweight or at risk for losing weight, it can cause significant problems for those folks. So it's not always all that well tolerated and sometimes does have to be stopped for those reasons. On the other end of the spectrum are the methylxanthines, sort of very old, inexpensive medications, things like aminophylline and theophylline. There is some evidence that they help with symptoms, may help slightly with reducing exacerbations, but in general, they are not that well tolerated. And if you can treat patients with sort of any of the rest of the armamentarium, it's certainly preferable to do that. They also likely have some risk of weight loss just with being more of a stimulant, more of an activator. Ideally, we try to avoid them. There are some patients who've been on them forever and ever and swear by them and refuse to give them up, and that's probably okay. But if you have a patient where you're starting out a new regimen, certainly not the ideal place to start. Sometimes cost is enough of a factor to where this is one of the few medications you can actually get for a patient. But again, not the ideal choice. So we brought up pulmonary rehab. This is one of those really simple ideas that makes a huge difference in people's lives. Pulmonary rehab is generally a 6 to 12 week program, generally 3 days a week, and staffed by exercise physiologists, respiratory therapists, nutritionists, social worker. There's always a supervising physician. And basically, it's a structured exercise and education program that can take patients from very poor functional status to improved status. Really, it's, as far as we can tell from the literature and from experience, it is good for everyone. The challenge is how it's paid for by insurance. Most insurances will pay for a limited number of sessions. And so finding that balance of my patient is bad enough to where they'll really benefit from it, it's not too early to get them involved, versus they're so badly off that they're not going to be able to participate at all. They're going to keep missing sessions because of exacerbations, and they're not going to benefit at this point, is a tough balance. Minimum of 6 weeks is really necessary to see the benefit. Longer, obviously, perhaps not obviously, but longer sessions have been found to be more beneficial. And then this maintaining the benefits, continuing the training at home, while difficult, is absolutely a key factor in maintaining those benefits. And it's really amazing when you meet someone who's been through pulmonary rehab, who started out, you know, very weakened, very short of breath, very limited in what they could do with their shortness of breath, gets benefit from those 6 to 12 weeks of rehab and sticks with a maintenance program, to see what they can do for months and years later is really just incredible. It's a really wonderful thing to see. We talked briefly in our dyspnea program about lung volume reduction surgery. And again, this does not apply for all forms of COPD, but particularly for those with emphysema, upper lobe predominant. And interestingly, it's those with poor exercise capacity who can really benefit from this. There's a lot of screening that goes on for cardiovascular disease and ability to tolerate surgery. You have to go through a full course of pulmonary rehab, be abstinent from tobacco use. But once you've been through the pulmonary rehab, if you're an appropriate surgical candidate, you go through bilateral upper lobe resections, which sounds like a tremendously huge surgery. I mean, going into both sides of your chest and cutting out big pieces of both lungs sounds absolutely astounding. It sounds huge. It sounds like it would be incredibly life-threatening. In general, people do very, very well with this. And it's incredibly gratifying to go in a day after their surgery. You know, they've still got a couple of chest tubes on both sides, but they will often be on back to their home oxygen level or less. They will be up and walking. And by the time they get out of the hospital, they're sometimes walking more than they were before they came in. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. And so there's good evidence that while it's an expensive process, it can help with health-related quality of life, it can help with exercise capacity, and it can even help with survival, which is pretty tremendous because there's not a lot of other processes out there for patients with bad emphysema that can do that. And it's really, for the right patient, it can be a really amazing thing. Attached to that, to some extent, is lung transplantation. Again, a very expensive process, a very laborious process, a lot to go through to qualify for it. There's evidence that lung transplantation for the appropriately selected patient, and that includes a wide variety of factors, social support, smoking cessation, physical body type, blood type, etc. But for the appropriately selected patient, it can improve health-related quality of life. For most disease processes, lung transplantation does not yet improve survival. The hope is that over the years, as the science improves, as selection improves, et cetera, that we may get to the point where it does improve survival as well. We're not quite there yet. And it is quite the process to go through. So certainly worth considering for a patient who is motivated, supported, appropriate in those ways, but not an easy path to go through. In terms of supports that we can use, non-invasive ventilation is something that we can use both acutely and chronically. In the acute setting, there's reasonable evidence that using it in an acute exacerbation of COPD can help to avoid intubation, can help to reduce the length of hospitalization, can help to reduce complications. In the chronic setting, it can help to, so nocturnal use can help to improve quality of life with chronic hypercapnic respiratory failure. Sometimes there's some forms that are easier to qualify for, some forms that are harder to qualify for. There is some overlap between the COPD syndromes and obstructive sleep apnea, which oddly enough can actually make it harder to qualify. But but there certainly with an appropriate sleep study, you can get that covered. And a lot of times we think about sort of when is this appropriate, when is it not appropriate. In the acute setting, somebody who is able to manage secretions, someone who is reasonably awake, alert, able to protect their airway, it's certainly a reasonable thing to try. If it's helping, okay to continue it. In terms of discontinuing, when you lose the ability to do those things, protect your airway, control your secretions, those sorts of things, or if it's just not helping, then it's certainly worth discussing, depending on the patient's goals, do we go to endotracheal intubation, or is that a limitation that the patient or a surrogate would set on what care is acceptable to them? In the chronic setting, essentially it's what can they tolerate, what are they willing to use, and what can their home setting support. And it's not common, but there are a few patients out there where their home setting just will not support the use of non-invasive at home. So thinking about symptoms, obviously dyspnea is the one that you think of most commonly. Lung problems, shortness of breath, and we've talked about that in separate issues. I did want to make one addendum to some of the comments I made in that dyspnea talk, which is that since then there's been a study that came out, retrospective review, population-based, looking at opioid use in older adults, 66 and older, with COPD in particular. There does seem to be some association between higher opioid use and adverse respiratory events. Again, it's population-based retrospective, so it's hard to say how that weighs out. It probably is worth some caution and discussion of risks versus benefits. I wouldn't say that this study is a stop the presses, we can't use those, but it may make us a little bit more cautious in terms of opioid use, particularly higher doses, and particularly in older adults. So worth a brief pause to consider that, but as always, further study is warranted. Cough is a very common condition with COPD. The bronchodilators can be helpful. There is weak evidence to support use of mucolytics, particularly in those with thick mucus. I tend to do N-of-1 trials. If they help the patient, great. If they don't, get rid of them. There is not great evidence for, and in fact, there's good rationale not to use antitussives. The cough can be maddening, but the failure to clear secretions, the failure to clear that mucus out, can certainly be a setup for adverse events in the future. So we certainly try to avoid those. Chest pain, you can imagine, would go along with a frequent chronic cough, with the muscle strain that comes from that, from the hyperinflation that occurs, and the muscle strain there. Can also certainly go along with things like coronary artery disease, acute coronary syndromes. Theoretically, if you have a coughing spell that bursts a bulla and you develop a pneumothorax, that can certainly be painful. So thinking about the chronicity of the chest pain, the character, is important in terms of the evaluation and management. Anxiety and depression, we've talked about, can happen separately and feed into the other symptoms that occur with COPD, but can also be caused by the limitations, the shortness of breath, the fatigue, etc. And then the isolation that can go along from being so limited by your breathing can certainly induce and contribute to worsening of depression. Fatigue is a fairly common symptom. Unfortunately, to date, there's no great way of treating this aside from maintaining activity as best you can from going through pulmonary rehab and maintaining the activity levels that you've attempted to achieve, and treating the underlying disease. And then weight loss and cachexia are a big part of as lung disease gets to be more end stage. And there's a lot of basic science looking into all the cytokines and immunologic phenomenon that cause COPD or pulmonary cachexia. There's not a lot out there about what to do about it, besides maintaining activity as able, resting when you need to, getting good sleep, and trying to eat nutrient-dense, calorie-dense foods. Certainly, as these processes progress, it can be more difficult to eat larger, fuller meals. So the more nutrient-dense, calorie-dense food that you can eat, or that you can encourage your patient to eat, the better, to try to maintain muscle mass. So prognostication, this is a really sticky subject, and unfortunately there's not a huge amount out there that helps us, particularly when we're thinking about when is it time to enroll this patient in hospice. You may be familiar with the SUPPORT trial, which is about, if I recall, about 20 years old now. And in the 5 days before a patient's death in that trial in the hospital, the APACHE 2 score, which is one of the critical care severity of illness scores that we use, predicted greater than 50% 6-month survival. This was 5 days before each patient died. It's not very helpful. FEV1 of less than 35% did help to some extent to predict mortality, but again, this is more the long-term view, 25% in 2 years. So not all that helpful for the acute process. Other factors that were found to be predictive, an even lower FEV1, dependence on oxygen, functional dependence, being in the hospital, some of these comorbidities, age, cachexia. But when you think about it, I mean, sicker people more likely to die sooner, makes sense, but not all that helpful. For inpatients, we get a little bit more help based on their blood gas. If admitted for an acute exacerbation of COPD, the mortality is nominally 10% for that hospital stay, and 33% in 6 months. Again, does that qualify for hospice? Does that lead us towards thinking about hospice? Maybe. Intubation for more than 48 hours. Again, 50% 1-year survival. That's actually pretty impressive. And then the other contributors are, as you'd expect, and not particularly earth-shattering or revealing. And then there's the BODE index, BMI, obstruction, dyspnea, and exercise capacity. So more on the outpatient side of things, a list of different factors that are a little more objective, where you can score a patient and look at their survival. The problem being, again, this is looking at 4-year survival. So useful in terms of thinking about advanced care planning, not necessarily so useful for do they need hospice now. And looking at that SUPPORT trial a little bit more, some of the things that they found in terms of preferences were that patients with COPD were pretty similar to those with lung cancer in terms of their preferences for no intubation and no CPR. The problem was that those with COPD were much more likely to get those interventions, even though they ostensibly didn't want them. And presumably that's because you hear the words cancer, you think, gosh, we need to think about these issues. COPD is a much longer process in general. And so that impetus to talk about these issues, to talk about preferences, to talk about values and goals is much more diffuse. And the care that we give these patients can be much more reactionary and much less proactively planned. A little more that they found: quality of life as it relates to health did not seem to predict preferences, which is interesting. One of the amazing things that I find with my patients with lung diseases is that it is absolutely amazing how they adapt to their disease. I've had people who were on just a little bit of oxygen and were incredibly short of breath all the time. I've had people who've been on 15 liters at all times, day and night, more when they're up walking, who say, "No, doc, I feel pretty darn good. Life is pretty good." It's incredible what people can adapt to and what they do adapt to. And really, the take home is that we don't do as well with advanced care planning for these folks as we need to. So hospice, just very briefly, when is it time? Obviously, the data about prognostication is pretty clear that that's a tough thing to do in these disease processes. The Medicare regulations talk about severely limited function because of dyspnea and fatigue from severe chronic lung disease, in addition to evidence of progression. And the way that they look at progression is with increasing ER visits, hospitalizations, visits from a home care physician for respiratory issues. So, somewhat helpful, but not super clear. It's not quite as clear as with something like cancer. There are some pieces of evidence that you can add into your narrative that adds support for use of hospice, but these are not necessary to your enrollment or disenrollment. And then what fascinates me about COPD and to some extent CHF, to my knowledge, there are no studies really quantifying this, but it's not uncommon to have a patient with COPD enroll in hospice. They've been going in and out of a hospital every month with exacerbations. Their functional status is absolutely bed to chair, with help. You know, you think, gosh, this really can't go on that long. And with the care that they receive in hospice, whatever it is about that change, it's not uncommon to see them improve. Reduced exacerbations, improved functional status, and you know, I think everyone who's spent some time working in hospice has seen those patients who have gotten to be too functional for hospice. And so their re-enrollment or recertification period comes up, and the hospice team sort of has to say, "You're too good. You're doing too well. We can't justify keeping you on our program. Call us when you need us." And it's not uncommon to see this back and forth pattern, and it can go on for several years. And it's really quite remarkable. But many, many people that you talk to who've been working in hospice for a time have seen this happen. So in summary, COPD is this heterogeneous category of diseases that can lead eventually to chronic respiratory failure. There's a high symptom burden with a lot of overlap, a lot of comorbidities. Prognostication is difficult, and there are some guidelines out there for hospice use, but it's really about the narrative, the functional status, and trying to build a case for that patient and continuing to follow where they are and how they're doing. So I hope that was helpful. And questions? All right. Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us. To review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.